Across the Pacifica network and over 50 community stations, this is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, July 24, 2003. From Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, I am Ian Forrest. Three more U.S. soldiers die as pictures allegedly confirming the deaths of Saddam Hussein's sons are circulated. ECOWAS directs Nigeria to send troops to Liberia. And three of five Pacifica stations vote down proposed bylaws. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Nigerian government says it is seeking the assistance of the international police to arrest an official of the American oil company Halliburton over a $2.4 million bribe the company paid to evade taxes in Nigeria. Sam Olokoye reports from Lagos.
Mr. Nuhu Ribadu, who is head of a body recently set up by the Nigerian government to combat financial and economic crimes in Nigeria, named an American, Michael Sylvia, as the man at the center of the $2.4 million bribery scandal. He said Michael Sylvia, who is an official of Halliburton, authorized payment of the bribe to a Nigerian tax official who also doubles as a tax consultant to the American Oil Services Company. The bribe was meant to reduce the tax liability of one of Halliburton's subsidiaries, Dresser Kellogg Oil Services Limited. Michael Sylvia is said to have fled Nigeria for New Mexico in the United States. Mr. Ribadu says the American is being sought by Nigerian authorities to explain its role in the bribery scandal. In the meantime, more than 1,000 Nigerian troops are to be deployed to Liberia to help stop the fighting in the West African country. The United States will bear the cost of the peacekeeping operation. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
Turkish Foreign Minister Abdullah Gül is in the USA this week to meet with the vice president and other high-level Bush administration officials. High on the foreign minister's agenda is discussing the possible presence of Turkish soldiers in Iraq. Ezgi Sertaj has more from Ankara.
Today, the Turkish foreign minister declared that if Turkish troops are sent to Iraq, they will not just serve as a police force. He said Turkey must also be allowed to aid in decision-making. Gül added that the Turkish parliament will have the last word regarding a commitment of troops. Many Turkish war opposers have made it clear that they would resist a decision to allow any Turkish troops in Iraq. The Turkish people think the USA is attempting to pull Turkey and its army into trouble. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ezgi Sertaş from Ankara, Turkey.
Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian prime minister, is visiting Washington for the first time since he took office. He will meet with President Bush on Friday and is meeting with members of Congress and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice today. Mohamed Galayini has more from Gaza.
The talks will focus on issues surrounding the implementation of the roadmap, namely lifting the siege of President Arafat, granting Palestinians unimpeded movement between all their cities, especially in the West Bank, stopping the separation wall in the West Bank, freezing settlement building, and freeing a large number of detainees without discrimination. The Israeli government had announced Wednesday that it would not free prisoners from Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the PFLP. At a sit-in for the release of prisoners in front of the Palestinian Legislative Council, Khalid Abu Sharkh, a member of the Popular Committee for the Protection of Detainees, said he has low expectations from the Bush-Abbas meeting.
With this regard, we do not trust the American administration to apply pressure to the Sharon government, especially since President Bush is in an election year.
He said that if there was no breakthrough regarding the release of detainees, the committee was planning a hunger strike. Meanwhile, in Israel, Israeli border patrols have shot and killed two Arab-Israeli motorists over the past 2 days. In today's shooting, 23-year-old Nasser Abulgi'an was driving Palestinian laborers to their work inside Israel. In both incidents, the police say the men didn't stop their cars at checkpoints. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Mohamed Galayini in Gaza.
Illinois Congressman Luis Gutierrez reintroduced a bill today that provides protections for day laborers and temporary workers. Chris Giovannis reports from Chicago.
Day laborers and their supporters gathered in cities across the United States today, including Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, to support the Day Labor Fairness and Protection Act. The proposed legislation would extend daily and weekly overtime pay, minimum daily pay, and other basic protections to workers at both temporary labor agencies and informal hiring sites. Jessica Aranda is a day labor organizer with the Latino Union of Chicago.
Putting this legislation into action would allow the worker centers to be created as hiring halls, but also as points where anybody in the community could come and learn about their rights as workers in the United States.
Other provisions in the act would allow day laborers to make legal claims against employers who do not follow its provisions and would prohibit agencies from sending workers to sites whose employees are on strike or lockout. This is Chris Giovannis of Chicago Indie Media for Free Speech Radio News.
And in a follow-up to a breaking story reported here on Free Speech Radio News yesterday, it has been confirmed that the shooter of New York City Councilman James Davis at City Hall was a political rival, 31-year-old Othniel Askew. New Yorkers wondering how Askew was able to bypass security with a gun have found out that as part of a councilman's party entering the chambers, Askew was able to bypass the security check. Askew was killed by return fire from a plainclothes policeman. Today, that policeman was hailed as a hero by Mayor Michael Bloomberg and promoted to detective. The councilman, a former policeman, spearheaded a Love Yourself, Stop the Violence campaign aimed at bringing an end to violence, particularly in the black community. Here now is the late Councilman James Davis speaking at a Stop the Violence rally.
Something is wrong with us as a people when we make the funeral after the fact and we put flowers all around the coffin. Flowers that the deceased cannot smell.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
While the U.S. military is today circulating images of the alleged bodies of Uday and Qusay Hussein as proof of their killings, 2 days ago, three more U.S. soldiers die. These three soldiers were from the 101st Airborne Division, which staged the attack on the Mosul Villa. This brings the number of U.S. dead to 44 since President Bush announced the end of combat in Iraq on May 1. Meanwhile, in the nation's capital, it's been a bad day for intelligence. The Pentagon admitted they underestimated the danger to U.S. troops occupying Iraq. The White House continues to dodge questions on its pre-war claims of an Iraq threat to global security. And as Josh Chaffin reports from D.C., the Joint Congressional Report on 9/11 intelligence criticized the FBI and the CIA.
As reporters struggled with each other this morning to get a copy of the 900-page congressional report on the 9/11 intelligence failures, Reuters was reporting on a poll that found almost one in three German people believe the U.S. government itself was behind the attacks. Washington is not Germany. The Joint Congressional Committee says better coordination between intelligence agencies may have helped to prevent the tragedies, but lawmakers were quick to say they're not pointing fingers. They say there's no smoking gun.
I can tell you right now that I don't know exactly how the plot was hatched on 9/11.
Florida Republican Porter Goss chairs the House Intelligence Committee, and he's a former officer with the U.S. Army Intelligence and with the CIA.
I don't know the where, the when, and the why, and the who in every instance. I know a lot more than I did. But we still can't fill in a lot of the blanks.
Democrats and some Republicans on the committee are complaining about the Bush administration's unwillingness to turn over a number of relevant documents. Some in Washington are curious to see a president's morning intelligence briefing from August 6, 2001 that's allegedly entitled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S., House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi.
For example, we were never able to get much of the material we requested from the National Security Council, specifically the records of the counterterrorism working group and written exchanges between the National Security Council and the intelligence community on counterterrorism proposals. And it took us 9 months to do all of our work, have our hearings, interview our witnesses, write the report, and it took 6 months for the administration to agree to some level of declassification. The report is overclassified. That is a disservice to the American people.
Republicans and Democrats have said that many important passages of the 9/11 report were unnecessarily redacted by the White House, including 28 pages dealing with foreign governments. Democrat Senator Bob Graham, who's also running for president, says the redacted stuff is the most significant information in the report. 15 of the 9/11 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. But Kyle Hentz is worried about the Pakistani connection. Hentz runs a popular website called unanswered questions.org.
General Mahmoud Ahmed, who is the head of the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Agency, approved a wire transfer of $100,000 to the lead hijacker, Mohammed Atta, in the weeks prior to 9/11. He was in the U.S., in D.C., meeting with George Tenet, Graham, and Porter Gass of the intelligence committees of Congress on the morning of September 11th.
According to a United Press International story, the report shows U.S. intelligence had no evidence Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11 or that Iraq ever supported al-Qaeda. UPI quotes retired Democrat Senator Max Cleland, who was on the 9/11 investigation, as saying the reason this report was delayed for so long is that the administration wanted to get the war in Iraq over with before it came out. Another 9/11 investigation is still in progress. The supposedly independent commission under the leadership of former New Jersey Governor Thomas Keene. That investigation is scheduled to wrap up its work about a year from now. The group issued a report this month declaring that they, too, were feeling stymied by the administration. Josh Chaffin in D.C. for Free Speech Radio News.
It is the first time in California history and only the second time in the nation's history that a sitting governor could be removed from office before the end of the term. Democratic Governor of California, Gray Davis, now faces a recall election on October 7, 77 days from now. Davis has the lowest approval rating in the state's history, a feeling shared by both liberals and conservatives. This while the country waits to see if actor Arnold Schwarzenegger is considering a run as a Republican. It appears the GOP is readying several candidates. It is also likely the Green Party will run a candidate. While recall opponents call it a right-wing coup, progressives are finding themselves in a familiar bind as to whether to support the Democratic governor they don't like or to vote for a third-party candidate which could help the Republicans win. Mitch Jezerich reports.
It is my duty today to certify the first recall election of a governor in California history.
California Secretary of State Kevin Shelley announced last night that with 1.3 million verified signatures, the recall of Governor Gray Davis is valid, and in the fall, the electorate will choose whether to remove Davis from office. Davis says, however, that he is ready for a fight.
But am I going to run away from it? Absolutely not. I'm going to fight like a Bengal tiger, and one of my greatest strengths is people have underestimated me since I was born.
Davis has not been accused of any criminal offenses, but for a California recall, there doesn't need to be any. The main thrust of this campaign has come from the Republicans. One Republican supporter is State Senator Tom McClintock, who could be considered the vanguard of conservative idealism in the state legislature. He is planning on running for governor himself, and he says the Democratic leadership of the state is over.
Well, I'll tell you this, I cannot believe in my wildest dreams that the people of California will vote to remove this governor from office for policies that have destroyed the state's finances, devastated its public works, killed its economy, and then turn right around and elect another Democrat to carry on exactly the same policy.
The recall probably would not have happened if Republican Congressman Daryl Issa, who has made a fortune selling car alarms, didn't donate over $1 million for paid signature gatherers. He is also running for governor. Still, his conservative ideology would make him a long shot on the left coast. But the number of candidates to replace Davis is unlimited, meaning the winner could end up with less than 20% of the vote. This is a grave concern for Alice Hoffman, who is the president of the state NAACP.
People who paid for this recall, it's bought and paid for. They're trying to buy the state. They don't stand for anything that we stand for. They're not for our civil rights. They're not for our environment. They're not for any of the issues that are important to not only African-American community, but many people of color and many people that are not rich. I mean, I think it's a move on their part to try to take over for the wealthy.
The recall puts progressives in an ever-familiar conundrum, either support Davis, who most of them dislike, or vote for a third-party progressive candidate, which could result in the election of a Republican. Peter Gamejo, who in the last gubernatorial election received 5% of the vote as a Green, says the recall election format that could conceivably have 10 candidates gives a third-party candidate a better chance of winning.
It's essential that I run because of the issues. There is no one else running for governor that is pointing out that poor people pay a higher tax rate than rich people, and that the reason we're having this disaster is not just because Davis is utterly incompetent, is that we do not have fair taxes in California. Corporations pay one half of the amount they used to pay in terms of the percentage of the budget.
Governor Davis needs all the help he can get to fight off the recall, but Bob Mulholland, a Democratic campaign advisor, makes it clear that the Democratic Party will not be embracing its more liberal side or reaching out to the Greens.
We can't please all the liberals, and we're certainly not going to please any liberals that didn't vote for Governor Gray Davis last November, November 2002. The Democrats always got to make sure that the voters of this state know that we're the one party that supports a woman's right to choose. We're the one party fighting to protect the environment. We're the one party that always stands with teachers and against the voucher system proposed by the Republicans and stuff. And we'll be doing that today and we'll be doing that next year. Does that mean we'll please everybody? No.
The recall is unprecedented in California. There is bound to be lawsuits along the way. A recall must take place within 80 days, giving election officials little time to prepare. Many people worry the election could turn into a fiasco resembling Florida in the 2000 presidential election. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Cheserich in Sacramento.
One day after Liberian President Charles Taylor announced his resignation date effective in 10 days' time, the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, officials met in the capital of Sierra Leone today to finalize details of troop deployment from Nigeria to Liberia. This follows a two-day meeting in Dakar, Senegal, during which the security wing of ECOWAS agreed to deploy troops to Liberia. Nigeria, one of the first countries directed to send troops, is looking for international support to pay for the deployment. Nigeria has already spent $8 billion sending troops to Liberia and Sierra Leone during 1990 to 1998. The executive secretary of ECOWAS today announced that the United States will contribute $10 million. Njaga Sek has more from the ECOWAS meeting in Dakar.
In the ECOWAS security meeting in Dakar, chiefs of staff from 10 of the ECOWAS countries discussed sending troops of up to 1,500 initially and expanding to 3,000 to Liberia. ECOWAS is a coalition of 16 West African nations, including Liberia, established to promote trade, cooperation, and self-reliance in West Africa. At the opening of security meeting, the Senegalese Minister of Armed Forces, Bekai Diop, says the new Partnership for Africa's Development, or NEPAD, takes the stability into account.
L'initiative pour la paix et la sécurité du NEPAD consiste en ces trois éléments.
The initiative for peace and security of the NEPAD consists in promoting security development, consolidating emergency skills for African institutions in order to prevent, handle, and solve conflicts.
Et l'amélioration de leur aptitude à prévenir, gérer et résoudre les conflits.
At the Dakar meeting, the Executive Secretary Mohamed Ibn Sambaz recalled the ECOWAS moratorium on proliferation of light weapons. The situation in Liberia adds to the instability in the sub-region. Crises in Cote d'Ivoire and Sierra Leone have shaken the socio-economic foundations of neighboring countries. Today, they trigger a proliferation of light weapons that fuels tensions in Mali, Guinea, and Senegal. Christine Arbuton Johnson is president of the Movement Against the Proliferation of Light Arms in West Africa, or MALAW.
On se rend compte que nous, en Afrique, nous en sommes victimes. La plupart des conflits armés sont...
We realize that we Africans, we are victims. Most armed conflicts happen in Africa, and Africans don't manufacture those weapons. In the discussion, I hope that you'll be able to insist on the damage, the humanitarian consequences, the dead, the injured, the sexual aggressions, all that can be done with armed conflicts.
On se rend compte que nous en Afrique, nous en sommes victimes.
Africa Strategic Research Center, part of the University of National Defense of the United States, organized the ECOWAS meeting in Dakar. Although the U.S. has made no commitments to sending troops, a representative from the State Department was in attendance to ensure that ECOWAS troops would still be deployed. Sheikh Omar Jara, ECOWAS Deputy Executive Secretary, also indicates that they have American military backup.
Europe est là avec nous. Elle sera à Freetown avec nous pour évaluer.
Mirov is here with us. She'll be in Freetown with us to evaluate the Nigerian battalions. In the same line, the same team will visit other countries contributing troops to see what supplementary means those units will need.
Mirov est là avec nous.
This decision comes on the heels of President Bush's recent five-country tour of Africa, where he met with three leaders of ECOWAS nations. A representative of the United States and the United Nations are meeting in Sierra Leone today with the commander of the ECOWAS security forces. This as the U.S. Navy redeployed 4,500 counterintelligence troops from the Horn of Africa to just off the coast of Liberia. In Senegal, this is Njagasek for Free Speech Radio News.
Democratic Senator Patty Murray has angrily denounced an Environmental Protection Agency decision not to fund cleanup of heavy metals in her home state of Washington next year. The plan is part of a controversial proposed expansion of the EPA's worst Superfund site. That is, a century's worth of mine tailings from the Bunker Hill mine upstream in the Idaho Panhandle. Leigh Robartes reports on the regional controversy, as well as emerging data about heavy metal toxicity nationwide.
The EPA intends to spend $360 million over 30 years to clean up toxic mine tailings up to 150 miles downstream from Idaho's Bunker Hill mine site, but all of the $16 million allocated for 2004 by the special agency panel that doles out Superfund money will be spent in Idaho. Chase Davis of the Sierra Club's Spokane, Washington office says there are health advisories for fish consumption as well as for children hanging out on the sandy beaches of the Spokane River in his city.
In terms of downriver in Spokane, yeah, you're talking about removing sand from beaches along the Spokane River and cleaning up those areas so that people aren't inhaling that dust.
The problem here is that there is not enough funding in the Superfund account right now.
Todd Webster of Senator Patty Murray's office says the Superfund tax, which is a levy on polluters, needs to be reinstated. Senate Bill 173, sponsored by Barbara Boxer, would do just that, but Webster says it's going to take some convincing to get Congress to act.
Unfortunately, the opponents to reinstating the Superfund tax are the folks that run the Congress right now.
Until last year, the EPA was only going to clean up 21 square miles of the most polluted land, known as the Box, located in Idaho's Silver Valley. When they decided the entire Coeur d'Alene Basin needed cleanup, they tried something new, putting a state-controlled commission in charge of implementing the plan. Chase Davis of the Sierra Club says the Basin Improvement Commission mostly consists of Idaho politicians hostile to the expanded cleanup in the two states who fear lowered real estate values and a damaged tourist economy.
We have a killing field of literally, you know, thousands of acres of wetlands that are holding these large contaminants. So yeah, we would need to go in and clean out those wetlands. That's not a very simple process. We have Lake Coeur d'Alene, where 70 million tons of toxic sediment is accumulated at the bottom of that lake. Again, Idaho officials lobbied very hard to exclude Lake Coeur d'Alene from this cleanup plan.
Health impacts from the Bunker Hill pollution aren't limited to the thousands of migrating waterfowl that succumb each year to lead poisoning. Those humans who lived nearest the Silver Valley smelter, especially as children, must often deal with developmental problems stemming from exposure to lead, zinc, cadmium, manganese, and other heavy metals. Roger Masters of Dartmouth University, president of the Foundation for Neuroscience and Society, was in the Silver Valley this weekend taking hair samples to screen for multiple toxins.
My studies show that toxic chemicals are a major factor in crime.
Masters says he's noticed similarities between Idaho's Silver Valley and Harlem, New York, when it comes to asthma, hyperactivity, attention deficit disorder, and crime, things he's linked to toxic exposure.
I've done a good deal of work on this, and it is clear that blacks are much more likely to absorb lead from the environment because they tend to have lactose intolerance. But it's also true that in New York City, they use a chemical to fluoridate the public water supply, fluosilicic acid, which has never been tested, but which has the effect of increasing the absorption of lead if there's lead in the environment.
Masters says lead will replace calcium lacking in black diets when bonding to form proteins because it has the same electrical charge.
We have these hidden issues that just have not been studied because the people in the field of education do not look at chemistry as the source of the problem.
Barbara Miller of the Silver Valley Community Resource Center says government testing has been minimal. So far, they've only done blood testing for lead.
Millions of dollars have been spent, and not one person has received
any diagnosis, accurate diagnosis and treatment, but that's where our organization is really intensely now going to work to implement the community-led health project, which will begin for the first time in 100 years getting health intervention.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis.
The struggle at the Pacifica Network to adopt new bylaws suffered a setback this week as three of the five Pacifica local station boards rejected the final bylaws draft. Evan Davis has more.
For more than 19 months now, the Pacifica Radio Foundation has been struggling to adopt new bylaws that will allow its listeners and staff to elect the Foundation's local and national governing boards, thus making Pacifica the first democratically operated national broadcast network in history. But this week, three of the five Pacifica local station boards failed to ratify the final version of the draft bylaws, which the California courts had ordered earlier this month to be sent to local boards for approval. Board members and activists in the network were deeply divided on the issue of racial diversity in the composition of Pacifica's boards. Everyone favored strengthening diversity, but some felt the only way to assure diverse boards was to create set-aside seats for people of color and to have this mandated in the bylaws. Mimi Rosenberg, member of the WBAI local board in New York, speaking at the meeting where the draft bylaws were defeated.
There is nothing more fundamental than how glib and how easy it is to say that what our responsibility here is to pass bylaws, change them ultimately, even if it means that there is nothing substantive and substantial about the inclusion of the disenfranchised historically in this country, and yes, in the white left movement as well. That's what the issue is about that has brought us to this.
But while the vote was substantially against the bylaws in New York and at Pacifica's Washington, D.C. station WPFW, two of the five station boards approved the bylaws overwhelmingly, and with the fifth station board at KPFK in Los Angeles, the vote was almost evenly divided. The bylaws were defeated there by a vote of 11 in favor and 12 against. KPFK local board member Lorraine Mirza, who supported the bylaws, spoke before the vote at the meeting this week.
The idea that draft B is somehow not for diversity really appalls me. This is not that kind of issue, and I think the divisiveness that has been used to present the other side has appalled me. It has hurt our ability to get along together. And it is time that we move on to elected boards.
Staff members at KPFK tended to support the bylaws, which would have guaranteed that one quarter of the new board representatives would be elected directly by the station staffs. Sonali Kolhatkar, host of KPFK's new morning program Uprising, is part of the staff delegation on KPFK's current interim board.
Issues of problems between staff and management at the station have fallen through the cracks. These issues have been continuously tabled, and I think it's time that that needs to end. And so with the backing of my staff, I voted to approve draft B of the bylaws, and I think the situation of the station is at such a high crisis that unless something happens soon, there's going to be a very, very serious uproar from within.
The new bylaws would also have offered representation on Pacifica's national board for Pacifica's affiliate stations. Norm Stockwell is the operations coordinator for WORT-FM in Madison, Wisconsin, a longtime Pacifica affiliate which played an active role in Pacifica's struggle for democratization.
Affiliate stations have long requested to be represented in the governance of Pacifica to reflect that two-way relationship of what it means to be an affiliate part of the Pacifica network, not merely a customer of a product delivered by the Pacifica satellite.
Ebon Dooley is the program director of another Pacifica affiliate, WRFG, in Atlanta, Georgia.
Having affiliates on there is an absolute essential, I think, particularly those that don't mirror the composition of the Pacifica stations. And I think with having affiliates on the board, you will get an increase to the diversity and viewpoints. And in due course, the representation of minorities would be included in that.
It will now be up to the California courts to decide the course of Pacifica's future. Pacifica's repeated failure to adopt new bylaws under the terms of the court settlement now in force raises serious uncertainties about the network's future. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis reporting.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Ian Forrest.